All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Right now, I'm back at home in the land of Israel after a long tour in the United States, and I'm in our offices in Hebron, as I'm the international spokesman of the Jewish community of Hebron. This morning, I was getting ready to... Last night, I went to sleep early after kind of having some jet lag, and woke up this morning to the horrific news that a terrorist attack struck in the heart of Tel Aviv, in the Sirona shopping plaza and the outside eateries and the restaurants. Four Israelis were murdered. Four Israelis murdered not in Judea and Samaria, not in eastern Jerusalem, but in the heart of Tel Aviv, which has certain implications, political implications, sociological implications. But it turns out that there's actually a lot more information about these murders that I didn't know about, that I think was I thought was very relevant. And I heard Noam Arnon, the veteran spokesperson of Hebron, considered by many one of the best articulators of Jewish rights in Judea and Samaria, talking on today's on a radio program with Eilat Radio today, explaining a lot more details about it. Noam, thank you so much for joining us. First thing, who were these terrorists? What was special about these terrorists? Once again, a group of terrorists are coming from Hebron region, which we've seen a lot of them specifically coming from our region here. What was also special about these terrorists?
Well, when I heard the names of those terrorists, they belong to the clan of the Mahamra. Mahamra is a very big clan in southern Hebron Hills, especially in Yatta, where they live. By the way, the biblical name is Yuta. Today, the Arabs call it Yatta. And many Arab names are based on Jewish names, ancient Jewish names that existed here in the land of Israel. Anyhow, the clan of the Mahamra actually were Jewish in the past. We have many researchers that prove it. The President Ben Tzvi, the second president of Israel, he was an historian. He wrote many, many famous books. And he actually visited those clans, and he describes how they light Hanukkah candles, and they actually preserve some Jewish commandments and some Jewish habitants. So they belong to an ancient Jewish clan that lived here in this country, supposedly from the time of the Bible and the Second Temple period. They went through all the generations, and they, when the Muslims appeared in this country, some of them were forced to convert to Islam, some of them converted to Islam. Anyhow, they became Muslims. But they still remember their origins as Jews. Now, it's quite famous that in the War of Independence, in 1948, one of the poor guys of the Mahamra happened to be in Gaza. And the mobs in Gaza identified him as a Jew, and they hanged him. They murdered him because he was Jewish.
But now, he was really an Arab, a Muslim
an Arab
person.
For many, many generations, it must be very clear, they are now Muslims. Mm-hmm. They have some background in Jewish history, but they are Muslims. Anyhow, this poor guy was hanged by Arab mobs as a Jew. And in 1967, when Israel took over, a delegation from this clan went out to meet the Israeli officer, begging him to connect this village to the water supply and to the electricity. And they said, you know, we are brothers, we are Jews, so please take care for us. But what happened next, what happened later was that Israel, unfortunately, did this horrible crime and brought the PLO, this terrorist organization, to control the area. Arabs in Hebron that I know that asked me and asked many, many others, please don't bring those terrible guys and terrible gangs upon our heads. They are terrorists. We don't want them here. This is what the Arabs said. This is a terrorist organization. What are you doing? They actually were waiting for us to take care for the whole area and to actually to make Israel sovereignty in this area, and they knew that Israel is the only democracy, modern state, that can take care for the rights. We must remember, they were never Palestinians. Palestine never existed. So they didn't want anything like Palestinian statehood or something like that. But unfortunately, the government of Israel did not listen to them. And the government of Israel brought the PLO to take care for the whole area. Now the population, the Arab population in this area, is under the pressure of terror. Now many of them had no choice. Israel had abandoned them. PLO, they had him. So they had no choice but to go to the Hamas, which gave them sort of an umbrella of identity, of dignity, of meaning to their lives. Unfortunately, after 20 years from the Oslo Accord until today, they are in a cage of terror which Israel had put them in. So a whole generation today, an Arab generation, had grew up in this cage of terror that we, Israel, had put them in. Now the results, as we can see, is terror. And unfortunately, they take revenge against us for abandoning them, for bringing the PLO on their heads. And this is a poor situation that, unfortunately, the state of Israel is responsible for.
So what you're saying is that by bringing in of this foreign entity of the PLO and then taking charge of the Arabs, what we've done is we've basically allowed a terrorist organization, which was going to teach terror, to basically be in control and to terrorize those citizens, those Arabs, and also to teach terror. On the other hand, though, you did say that even in 1948, somebody who was even suspected of being Jewish, and this is way before the PLO, was hanged. So it's not like the PLO was the first to introduce anti-Israel and anti-Jewish ideas.
Of course, because what I say was that after 1967, when they understood that Israel is the superpower, that the Jews are so strong and brave and clever, this is when they understood that they must have this Jewish sovereignty under Israeli umbrella. Before then, they still, in 1929, in 1948, all those wars and terror actions against Jewish communities, they still had dreams to uproot and to throw the Jews out. After 1967, I remember, as a child, 12 years old, I remember very, very good, when we went over touring the whole Judea and Samaria, Shechem, Nablus, Ramallah, Tul Karem, Jenin, Hebron, Bethlehem, everywhere. Arabs were standing around and you know, admiring us and giving us everything and fruits and grapes and everything. And then we had the chance because they were expecting those angels, those Jews, to take over and to bring Jewish sovereignty and modern period and democracy to this area, and we did not do it. Mm-hmm. We betrayed our historical mission, our biblical mission, and our Arab friends. Now many of them take revenge now for what we did. What I say is not closing our eyes and all our senses against the terror. Terror should be destroyed. All the terrorists must be demolished. That's for sure. It's not a question. But I speak about the population which are not terrorists. And many, many of them are not terrorists. And we have to supply them modern conditions and development and water and education and health and everything.
Speaking of non-terrorists, Noam Arnon, you knew one of the people who were victims yesterday, one of the four victims of this terrorism that murdered the Jews in the heart of Tel Aviv. You knew one of them. He's actually a researcher who dealt with the issues of Jews of Judea and Samaria and was the head of the Israel Studies Department at Ben-Gurion University. Tell me about him.
Michael Feige, I knew him. He interviewed me a lot of times. He mentioned me in his books. Well, he did not tell with our opinion, but he was quite fair man, quite nice guy, and I'm very, very sorry for him to be killed.
Yes, he was murdered yesterday, and this was a blow to Ben-Gurion University. Also, an executive at the Coca-Cola plant in Bnei Brak was also murdered yesterday, and also two wives, and a lot of people, tens of people injured in this horrible attack. This attack comes in the beginning of Ramadan season. What do we expect for the rest of this Ramadan? Is this going to set the tone? There was 2 hours before the attack yesterday, Gadi Eisenkot gave a speech saying, "We have overcome the wave of terror."
Well, as we know from the past, and I call everyone from our audience to make sure that I'm right, whenever there were talkings about a sort of political horizon and political solution for the Israeli-Arab conflict, beginning talkings, regional talks and dialogues, all that brings terror. All those processes bring terror, and this is what happened when they talk about sort of new talkings between Israelis, Palestinians, etc. When the terror organization smells this terrible smell, they begin
the weakness.
A smell of weakness. They begin to act, and this is exactly what happened.
And you're referring, of course, to the new coalition, which immediately, this so-called nationalist coalition, immediately began discussions about somehow accepting the parameters of either the Saudi peace proposal, and there's the French peace proposal, and then we want two states, and instead of a nationalistic, strong coalition, immediately what we got here in Israel, what we always get when we get the strong right, we actually somehow get delivered the weak left in terms of land giveaway. It's a problem, certainly. Let's hope for a better period here in this Ramadan, which is going to be already started very tense, and we'll see how it continues. Noam Arnon, you're the spokesman of the Jewish community of Hebron. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, and let's hope for good. Okay.
All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Noam Arnon here in our beautiful offices in Hebron. When are you going to come visit us in Hebron? If you can't visit us, check us out on the internet, hebron.com. Very important. And of course, if you want more great audio from Israel, thelandofisrael.com. It's a great honor and privilege to be part of this network. Now, for the rest of the show, there's audio that I recorded on the road in the United States of America. You're going to hear from Mordechai Levovitz, a gay rights activist, comes from the Orthodox world, and I think that that's going to be interesting, potentially explosive. So you let me know what you think about that by writing me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Then finally, we'll finish off today's show with a talk with Rabbi Jesse Horn from Yeshivat HaKotel on the airplane, so we'll be live on air. So stay tuned. Here's Mordechai Levovitz. Right now, I'm on a train to Manhattan. I just landed from Los Angeles, California, and heading early morning, took the red eye, and now heading early morning to the Israel Day Parade. It's a cloudy, overcast weather here in New York, but it's great to be in New York on the way to Aliyah. Like, from Los Angeles to New York, it feels like Aliyah, and one more shot out to Eretz Yisrael after the parade. And on the way to the parade, I bumped into an old friend, Mordechai Levovitz, who is a long-standing advocate for Jewish gay rights, LGBTQ rights. We'll get through that. And I wasn't just talking about the letters of the subway. I'm talking about letters that stand for something else altogether. Mordechai and I know each other for a long time. We've had many debates and discussions and friendship. And he just came back from Tel Aviv, where Tel Aviv had a giant rally parade, a gay pride parade.
Yep.
And it was, he said, 200,000. I read in the newspapers, 300,000 people. So this was a major gathering of the pro-gay community in Israel. And it was basically covered all over. He was there as part of a mission for the Jewish Federation?
Yeah, the JFNA, the Jewish Federation of North America. We had an LGBT mission to Israel. We were here for about 10 days, and it was incredible.
So, Mordechai Lvovitz, thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
And many of my listeners will be very surprised that you're on my show, just because these are not the kind of topics we usually cover. Tell me a little bit about the parade that you just flew to Israel, and now you're flying from Israel to get here to join the Israel Day Parade here. So you're marching in both
places.
I'm
going from parade to parade.
Okay.
Like a true gay man. We gather together, it's a parade, like Jackie Mason used to say. First of all, I really like the way you described it. I don't know if you realize, but when you described the parade in Tel Aviv, you described it as the pro-gay parade. And I think that that's so interesting that you framed it that way, because it's not just a parade for LGBT people, because when you go there, you realize basically it's 90% of Tel Aviv comes out and comes to this parade. So I would say it's very significantly people who are allies, family members, and just people who love a great party and love this country, and it's so awesome. So, and I don't think you realized when you said the pro-gay parade,
but I think that's really kind of what it was. Yeah, that's the way I think of it.
Yeah.
That's exactly the way I think of what you just said. You know, some of the critiques of these kind of parades in general have been that they're not really about rights or recognition or pride. A lot of times they're just sex parades where people where there's a certain kind of exhibitionism that happens there, and there's a critique. You know, I critique a lot of times. I'll be in an airport, there'll be a public screen of some kind, and they'll show things that are just not appropriate for children and other things. And a lot of times these parades, at least in the past that I have been witness to, and I don't know what happened in this one, and that's my question to you. What was this parade like? Was it about sexuality, or was it about, I mean, exhibitionists of dress that might be inappropriate for children or anything like that? Or was it really about rights or recognition?
I think once again, you, with your analogy, you really hit it on the mark. When you go to the airport and you see the ads for perfumes, they're women in bikinis. When you go to the Puerto Rican Day Parade, there are women in bikinis. Our culture has a certain sexuality to it, for good, for bad. I think it's definitely a question of modesty, but I think it's a greater question of 2016 culture that is somewhat sex-obsessed. I think it's unfair to say that it has something to do particularly with LGBTQ people. You just don't realize it because we're so used to seeing women in bikinis and men in bathing suits on every single perfume ad and every single Abercrombie & Fitch ad. We don't realize it. But the truth is that that's a question about culture in general, and I do hear a critique. I mean, from a Jewish values point of view, that modesty is a real value. That's a solid critique, but it's a critique on modern culture. It's not really a critique on LGBTQ people. Every parade I've ever been to has that kind of exhibitionist.
Not today's Israel Day Parade.
Jerusalem Day Parade, you mean?
Well, it's the Israel Day Parade on Jerusalem Day.
That's actually not true. No, that's not true. So the Bukharian float has a woman in a bikini top. You'll see her, and a belly dancing bottom, and she's going through the parade. So even in the Israel Day Parade here, unfortunately or fortunately, again, it depends what your take on society. When people dance, sometimes when people show off, they show some skin. Again, like I said, I get
your point, Mordechai, and we're speaking with Mordechai Lvovitz, your organization that you started, and you've been an activist in this field for so long, really since I knew you.
Yes.
And I saw you kind of in starting that whole process.
Oh, yeah.
And you really took it all the way. And that I'm proud of you in the sense that you had a mission that you wanted to do, and you took it to kind of its conclusion of promoting it on a bigger scale. But I was arguing with you about it still back then.
Mm-hmm.
Your organization is called Jewish Queer Youth. Now, this word queer and the word gay, these are words that transform. It's almost like the word settler. It's like it starts out being good, and then it turns out being bad.
Bad,
in your
then
case,
good again.
In your case, right.
Yeah.
In your case, you're using the word queer within the title of your organization.
Yeah. Why, there are two reasons why we use the word queer. One, because we're a youth organization, and that's the way kids are defining and identifying themselves. So I want to be able to, you know, be a little ahead of myself and have the kids feel good.
Want
to
be
about,
on Snapchat.
Yeah, well, I mean, that kind of thing. I mean, I'm on Alta Kaka. I mean, I don't even know from Snapchat. But it's important. It's important that the kids feel good about the name of the organization. And that is, like I said, for better or for worse, the terminology that the younger kids are using. Another good thing about the word queer is it's not just an alphabet soup acronym like that you said before. LGBTQI, you know, whatever. It's very hard to stay and remember. It's constantly changing. If there was one word that can encompass all of them, wouldn't that be great? So queer is an umbrella term.
Gay was no good? Well, I thought gay was a good way to turn it around because that meant, like, happy. Queer, the word queer, it has a negative connotation in classical English.
Well, the issue with calling it gay is that trans people don't consider themselves gay.
Uh-huh.
So, or bisexual people don't consider themselves gay. So it's not fair. We want them to feel like they're part of the community.
How is it that the transsexual discussion has taken such a prominence when what is the numerical... I mean, it's almost as though, like, here I'm colorblind, as though there would be, you know, such a concern with colorblind people. It seems to me like there's, like, such a huge discussion over transsexual people, and yet, what percentage of society is this?
Well, I mean, when you think, let's talk, if you want to talk numbers, we can talk numbers. We don't even have to get to the transgender people. Let's just talk about intersex people, right? Intersex people are people who are born with ambiguous genitalia. When they are born, the doctors don't know whether they can't say. So it seems that there is, it's like 0.02% of the population, very, very small percentage. But the interesting thing is, you know what percentage of the population they are larger than? I'll give you a little hint. Jews. So there are more intersex people then there are Jews.
But I don't have a Jewish bathroom when I go to the bathroom.
Wait a second. But the intersex people is actually the minority of the transgender community. The majority of the transgender community, people say it could be up to 1% of the population, which is much more, many, 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 many thousands of people more than the Jewish people. So you are talking about a very significant segment of the population who identify as transgender. Now, the important thing is that this population is also not doing well in terms of homeless youth, right? Let's say just in New York, homeless youth. 40% of the homeless youth under 18 consider themselves transgender.
Wow.
That's nuts. So when you think about it's a significant population of human beings who are not doing well, immediately...
Is it a cause or is it a result? Or
we don't really know.
Is it because you're homeless so you kind of...
If you're asking my opinion is that these kids are kicked out of their homes, right? These kids are kicked out of their homes because their parents don't accept them.
Oh, because they're transgender?
Yes.
Right. Not because they're homeless.
No,
swinging in different directions.
right. Although that would be
I
very...
I don't know what the
facts are. No, that would be an interesting argument. Again, someone can make that sociological argument. However, I think the more compelling argument once you meet them is that they were transgender. They were starting with gender non-conforming behavior at home. Let's say, you know, their mom told them, you got to wear pants, but they were like, no, I need to wear a skirt, and that so much friction happened, and then they were kicked out of their house because their house was unsafe. So in New York City, which is this huge, one of the largest cities, if not the largest city in the world, 40% of the homeless youth are transgender. We have to do something as humans. As Jews, we have to do something.
Right, and that leads me exactly to the next question. The first word in your organizational name, and in basically what you've been doing all these years, you have not been only an advocate of homosexual and other queer
sexuality. It's helpful.
Yeah, I guess you're right. You've actually been an advocate for specifically Jewish.
Yes.
And that dovetails with also Orthodox. You come from an Orthodox background, and we were both at an Orthodox institution, Yeshiva University. One time, you or your friends, very seared into my memory, brought the gay Orthodox rabbi.
Yeah, Rabbi Greenberg.
Yes. So-called gay Orthodox rabbi. That's debatable. But in any case, that was one of the things I debated, which is whether are you Orthodox or not. But certainly one thing cannot be debated.
Were you there? Did you come?
Yeah, come on.
You came to the event.
Come on. Gosh, that was like a... That's amazing.
That was like...
I'll never forget that.
One of the first ever Orthodox LGBT events. But
right.
Yes.
Well, just very quickly, I want to tell you that my memories from that are that I had to go somewhere else. So I raised my hand the minute there was the first chance, and I started arguing with him quickly.
Uh-huh.
I basically got to the point where I said, listen, you're not – you. He said that he didn't believe that the Torah understood what it was talking about in this case. And therefore, I said, oh, in that case, we don't have an argument because you're not really Orthodox. Orthodox means that you believe that the Torah is infallible. And if you're Jewish and you like kosher style and you like Orthodox and you enjoy it, you want to go to shul, that's one thing. But you're trying to fuse Orthodoxy and homosexuality, which are not fusible in my opinion in any case, or in classical Orthodoxy's opinion, but you're not trying to do that. Your thing is Jewish. Jewish, there's no doubt that Jewish, there are Jewish homosexuals, Jewish queer people, and that there is a large amount of Jews who are interested and supportive and want to, in some way, be advocates for the LGBTQ queer community.
Well, yeah. I mean, to respond to the first thing that you said, I think you have to be able to separate a point of view or opinion about a verse, right, which could then consequently make you Orthodox or not Orthodox, depending on your definition of Orthodox, which is an absolutely valid point of view. Many people do describe Orthodoxy with a certain understanding of Torah min ha-shamayim, so absolutely, you're coming from...
God-given from heaven,
yes,
means
God, yes,
just translating
God,
for everybody.
Right,
yeah.
God-given from heaven.
And therefore perfect, infallible.
Correct. But again, that is one person's point of view about the verse in the Torah. I mean,
that's what Orthodoxy is usually...
I'm talking about Rabbi Greenberg.
Right.
Rabbi Greenberg's is Rabbi Greenberg's reinterpretation of that pasuk is one person's point of view. And we learn Gemara every day. I mean, people have a million different points of view. And of course, points of views have consequences, like you said, and we can debate about that, whether it's Orthodox or not. However, but the reason why my organization is very much connected to Orthodoxy, I love it. We just arrived to New York. Maybe we can go to a cafe and continue the conversation.
What station are we at?
We're at Penn.
Oh, so let's take a pause and we'll continue.
All right.
All right, folks, we're back here. We took a little break. We were on the LIRR coming in from Jamaica. That means basically from JFK into Manhattan. And I bumped into an old friend and somebody who really has made a name for himself promoting the agenda and the issues of the LGBTQ, and we kind of made fun of that it sounds a little bit like the subways of Manhattan.
Right, or alphabet soup.
Mordechai Levavitz is also the executive director of Jewish...
Queer Youth.
Jewish Queer Youth. JQY. Those are not letters that usually go together. JQY. And Mordechai just came back from a delegation, no less than a delegation.
Over 100 people.
Over 100 people. Probably not all gay, but...
All gay.
All gay or also just...
All LGBTQ,
right,
except
saying,
for some staff,
right,
from
who are
JFNA, who are supporters,
right.
Yes.
JFNA, which means, by the way, just let's make it clear, that means the Jewish money, New York Jewish money...
Jewish Federation of North America.
Right.
Absolutely. It's a Jewish money. Yep.
Right. And interesting. It's exactly the question I wanted to get to you with right now. I don't remember exactly where we got it cut off before we moved. That's
I remember, so I'll be able to catch up too, but okay.
My next real question to you is, I was talking about... that some try to describe themselves as Orthodox. I don't think that's fitting, and I think it's problematic. But we're not going to go there because we're going to go to a different place. You are very much identified as Jewish, and anybody who knows you knows that that's a big part of your identity. You're not trying to promote general LGBTQ rights and issues. Rather, you're coming from a Jewish place. You're trying to make an organization for Jewish people. Tell me about that. Let's call it fusion or support of that community that's specifically Jewish. You're not dealing so much with Gentiles. You're marching in short succession in the Israel, in the Tel Aviv Gay Pride Parade, and now at the Israel Day Parade as part of a delegation here as well. So you're very much Jewish, and anybody who knows you knows that you're, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but I guess the title of your organization gives it away that I'm not wrong. That being Jewish and Judaism and being identified as a Jewish person is important to you.
Yes. You have a little... bug on you. I just said. All right. So let me connect it to where we came from. In 1999, when you had that interaction with Rabbi Greenberg, I think that we were asking the wrong question, and that's why we got the wrong answer. We ended up in kind of Rabbi Greenberg, and you ended up in a discussion where you actually left feeling kind of bad. And I think asking the question, can you be Orthodox and gay, is an unhelpful question from a Jewish social service perspective, because that question is unanswerable. It depends what you mean by Jewish, it depends what you mean by Orthodox, and it depends what you mean by gay. Can you be Orthodox and gay? I don't know. I don't know that answer. But what I do know is that we as Jews have to ask a much better and more important question. What is the Jewish community doing about the LGBTQ Jews within the Jewish community that are not doing well, that are suffering, that are isolated, that may be homeless, that may be looking for some sort of dignity, some because they have such low self-esteem? What are we doing? That question, right? And that question can even be asked of the Orthodox community and should be asked of the Orthodox and the Haredi community and the Hasidic community and the Sephardi community. What are you doing? Every single yeshiva, we have to ask that of the yeshiva.
I agree with you.
There are gay people in your yeshiva. What are you doing to make sure that they are not suffering?
All right, we just let's take a pause on that. I want to make a... We probably won't be able to dig deep into this issue, but I want to say that very much mixed into our discussion, and I already feel it upon myself, is the issue of political correctness and what can be said, what cannot be said. I can tell you that if you even go so far as to mention that homosexuality is a tendency, and that tendency by some people may not want that tendency, and they may seek some approaches to try to reverse or distance themselves from that tendency, that is almost, you cannot bring that up. Immediately they come down on you like a boom. They clamp down on you. You know what's amazing to me? My friend recently said to me that he teaches at a university. He told me that they have these sensitivity sessions where professionals come in, lawyers, and they come and they teach them that today in Israel, if you ask a girl out once, that's okay, but a second time, that's already sexual harassment, okay? And this guy raised his hand, and he was like, yeah, but I would have never married my wife had that been the truth, okay? So you're not allowed, there's all kinds of limitations on heterosexuality where it's like, whoa, this could be explosive. But within homosexuality and LGBTQ, that whole thing, that's almost like carte blanche. You can never even say something like it's completely politically incorrect. And by the way, the courts here in the United States have affirmed that it's almost illegal to basically suggest that homosexuality is, for even for those people who want to be cured, meaning to voluntarily come in, and even that word itself, it's like, whoa. Did you just say cure? That's like, are you implying that it's a wrongness, a disease, some kind of anything? It's like you can't even throw out. The whole condition is that these people that you're talking about that need need love and support, which I completely agree with, but there's simply no Orthodox or classical Orthodox option within that discussion for anything but recognition, a coming out, and equality and all that. And it's a civil rights movement, basically, and the only path forward is to grant full recognition and civil rights and almost encouragement for anybody who senses that tendency.
All right. So let me take it down back to reality for a second, because you talk very big and in very big generalizations, and it's important to realize everything that you're saying...
Help me out.
Yes. And everything you're saying is more complicated. So... when it comes to the issues of conversion therapy, I don't think anybody, certainly not me, I don't want to speak for anybody but myself. So
no, you do speak for other people. You are a leader in this movement.
I speak for whatever people follow me, I'll speak for.
Okay.
In my capacity as leadership.
That's all I mean to say.
Some things they will disagree, some things they will.
Like a good leader. Your opinion is more than just a private man.
Thank you. I think it's pretty understandable that when people who are gay in the Orthodox community, and especially when they grow up Orthodox and they first realize that they're gay, their first instinct is to wish and hope that they were not gay, right? That they could marry within the way that their mother and father and community will celebrate. They'll live the dream of chuppah, ma'asim tovim. Like, this is the dream. This is the communal dream. So much so that even single straight people within the Orthodox community feel very marginalized, right? There's no real place for a single straight person, so being married. And so it's understandable to me that many, many people in the Orthodox community who are gay, including myself when I just came out, very much wished that I was not gay. So I never want to downplay or pretend it doesn't exist or devalue the idea of I think, the thousands of people, or certainly the hundreds of people that I know, who, are we video or okay, who very much wish that they were heterosexual, and they wish that there was a process to change them from homosexuality.
You know people like that?
I know many people. I have friends. I was that. So I know that from personal thing. Now, and I think I'm not a big believer in reinventing the wheels. I believe that, you know, the halacha, the mesorah, the way that the Jewish community evolved, there's something to it. You know what? And I understand that there are many people who would love, 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 love to eat bacon. And bacon is a wonderful thing. They smell bacon and they're like, oh, geschmack, bacon, right? and they're suffering because they wish they could just, like everyone else, eat bacon. If there was, but I would be very hesitant. I notice, it's very interesting that the Orthodox community in the last 100 years' response to this need to eat bacon has not been to, don't worry, go to a psychologist. They will help you not like bacon anymore. That's it. You have a problem. I understand your problem. That's it. Go to a shrink. And no, that hasn't been the response. And yet, why? Because it's very normal.
Are you referring to products that taste like bacon?
So what has our response been, right? I always look back to look forward. Kedem, kadima. It's the same thing. You have to look back to look forward, right? So what has been the holy Orthodox response, right? What do? We make Hebrew National, right? Hebrew National is so good that even the goyim eat Hebrew National, right? We're delicious. We have sausages that are better than your bacon sausage. We have delicious food. Go to a deli. Jews reinvented the whole deli,
Wait. You're exaggerating. We've never created, our bacon is no Gentile
maybe
thinks,
it's no,
oh, that Jewish bacon is better than real pig bacon. What are we getting
to? But pastrami.
Okay, but that's legal. There's no problem. There was never.
This is what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that that psychology and psychologists and calling something, you know, wanting to do something that's problematic in halacha, right, is normal. And psychologists and psychiatrists are not the people to go to when you struggle with not with wanting to do something that is usher. Now,
they're not?
We want, no.
What about AA meetings or many other forms of many people struggle with all kinds of unwanted addictions and problems?
That's a very good
question.
I can answer.
And I'll let you answer that.
Yeah,
I'll let you answer that. I do want to let you, but I want to make a caveat, and that is, I don't want to get into this too far, and I'll tell you why. Because the truth is, I don't know if I understand that plight, and I want to have a certain amount of sensitivity for the plight. I do.
But I'll reframe it very quickly to go back to your question. My point is that the point and the problem with reparative therapy is not that people want to change. The question is whether or not you can use the tactic of psychology and mental health to change someone's sexuality. So that immediately takes all
the...
Let's take all the politics out of it. Let's take all the emotion
out of it.
That's just a classic question that needs to be studied.
If I had narcolepsy,
all of these things, right? I'm a therapist, so I'll tell you, one of the things we learn when we learn mental health is that we question what are the limits, what are the things that, what are interventions that work and what are interventions that don't work. We have blind studies, a double blind study. We have unbelievable research and scientific method. And then we come out in the end with some research, and if the research shows that a process works that's within the canon of mental health, and if it shows, for example, if someone just wants to be taller, it doesn't matter how many, but you go to a therapist day and night, you're not going to become taller in therapy, right? And if someone said that you can go to therapy to get taller, that person is doing something, is doing a fraud, right? Because you can't go to therapy. You can go to therapy to feel better about being shorter. Absolutely. 100%.
Why are Jews so concerned with the issue? Why are they so disproportionately representative in the leadership roles of the gay world? Why is Israel, for example, is it because of...
First of all, I don't think that Larry Kramer is not... That Larry Kramer, which is like the leader of the modern gay rights activist movement, the one who really got us to start thinking about the government's response to HIV, was a proud Jew. I think that the...
is or isn't?
Is a proud Jew. Yeah. I mean, so we actually are the leaders of the LGBT movement.
Oh, so that's, so you're agreeing with that assertion. Okay.
I think we are. I thought you were assuming that we aren't. But I want to.
No, I'm assuming they are. I say, why are they so?
We are. Why do Jews? I don't know. Why are there so many Jews on the Supreme Court?
Right.
You know. Why, I mean, I don't know. We're amazing people. What can I say? I mean, listen. I am all about pride. I think you got to look at yourself and you got to feel great about yourself. And you never should apologize about yourself. I'm never a big one of these people. Oh, I'm so sorry. I can't. I'm sorry that my skin is this color. I'm sorry that I'm part of this religion. I'm sorry that I live in Lawrence and I don't live in Far Rockaway. I don't understand. No. Everybody needs to look into themselves and see what they have that makes them amazing. Because you know what? We have a lot of stuff that makes us disgusting too. Right? So we can get very depressed. And the important thing to go on to be a happy person, to be able to take care of other people, is to be able to find that strength within yourself and be proud and love it. So yes, 100%, Jews are incredible people. What we're able to accomplish in terms of leadership, in terms of giving to the world, in terms of science, is miraculous. But you know who are also great people? Indians. When actual Indians. Unbelievable what we've learned from India. You know, we're also great people. England, what would we be? Where would we be without Great Britain and the people? So, yes, we are amazing people. We should have a lot to be proud for. And, yes, we're very influential in the LGBT community, as we should be. I'd expect so.
Mordechai Lefavitz is the executive director of Jewish Queer Youth. And he just came back from marching in Israel. The march in Tel Aviv is not so much contested, but the march in Jerusalem is. And the question is, borders, is it fair for a community to never want to accept this thing? Or is it fair for another community, let's say the gay community, to say, no, this is something that needs full acceptance, it needs to be there? Where is the line that... segments of society can say, I don't want this in my life. I don't want this. And I see this in classical terms. I've seen this fight before, and I don't want to lose it. I don't want my children to succumb to it.
You have seen this fight before, because before we were on the radio, we were having a discussion a little about what Israelis love to discuss about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And we both mentioned that not in a in every community, a Jew, there should not be a community where a Jew shouldn't be able to live, and not only live, be proud that they're a Jew, right? Because what's the point of living without dignity, right? Every community, they should live and be proud and have a flag and show, I am Jewish. The exact same thing should be for LGBTQ people, especially if they already live there, right? There are just as many LGBTQ people living in Meisharim. In Meisharim, I am a proponent of having the Gay Pride Parade not in West Jerusalem and Jaffa. The Gay Pride Parade should go through Meisharim, the same way that you are a proponent that the Israeli parade should go through the Muslim quarter. We're the same in that sense.
It's an interesting.
Nobody ever should feel ashamed about who they are.
No, it's
life
not about ashamed.
About
it's actually,
dignity.
Wait
and
a minute.
Self-esteem.
Wait a minute. But it's about respecting also other people's borders. They shouldn't feel ashamed. Wait a minute. Hold on. They shouldn't feel ashamed that they don't. That's against their religion.
There's no.
They shouldn't feel ashamed to say no. We don't want this in our. Wait a minute. And when you go into an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood, it says very clearly on signs, please wear modest clothing. This is important to us. And if somebody comes in with immodest clothing, it's offensive to them. It's offensive to them. In this world of offense, you know, the constitutional right to be offended, it's like the conservatives never have a right to be offended anymore. I don't mean conservative in an American sense.
Let me tell you something.
Don't get stuck on that.
No. Let me tell you something. You're talking to the wrong guy. I don't think liberals have a right to be offended. I think everybody should be offended.
Wait, but you said very passionately a minute ago that the gay pride parade should go through Mass Shire.
100%.
But you understand that that is very offensive to them.
Yeah, and if they said that black people are offensive, they don't like black.
But I'm asking you the other side.
You have a right to your offense. You can feel any.
Can't you have rights to your neighborhood?
Your offense. Your offense.
Is everything public? You can't have. You can't.
Let me answer your question. Right. I think that in terms of dress. Right? In terms of dress, in terms of modesty there, and what can be considered immodest, what can be considered, overly sexual. It could be that there is a general understanding that when you are, meaning everybody, this affects everybody the same way, right? That we all could dress, for example, we all dress in suits when we go to visit the president. If you came in a beach, if you came in a bathing suit and flip-flops, you probably wouldn't be able to get in. No, that's something I can believe in. But an identity based on who you are, I'm not saying that gay people should walk in their town naked. But what I am saying is that the gay kid who lives in Mea Shearim has a right to not only live there, has a right to be proud about who he is, be able to have a flag about who he is. Who he is. Who he is. Not how he acts. Not how he dresses. Who he is.
Is a
and
gay person.
Is
a gay
there's
person,
no modesty
is
against
gay
that.
An identity?
Of course.
It's not a sexual proclivity?
It's like it's also, right?
It just seems like
you keep Shabbos, right? That Orthodox, it's like Orthodox, right? Orthodoxy is
well,
a
is
halachic proclivity, and there's also an identity, and that's why we have the problem. Some things are listen. That's the interesting thing about identity, right? You could describe me in front of you as a male white man with blonde hair, and that's all you see, or you can say I'm Mardechai. There is a sense of identity and who I am that's connected more to self-esteem, right? What I do and descriptive terms, right? I ate oatmeal today. I don't have a right to be so proud that I ate oatmeal today, but I have a right to have a self-esteem about who I am. Because that's like we said, connected to dignity. There's no life without dignity.
There's a lot more questions that we have to discuss, and this is, of course, one of the big issues of our time. There's no question about it that this whole issue of sexual politics, and when I said, by the way, also we've seen it in the past, this was a war that was fought in Hanukkah, in part, is the fight between Orthodoxy and Greco-Romanism. There was a huge component of homosexuality. I'm not
a revisionist understanding of Hanukkah, but all right.
I think that's the more accurate. I think it's revisionist to make
it
all about.
We can talk about Hanukkah.
We'll have to do it at a different time. The point is, I think you'll agree with me. This is one of the hot and big issues of our time, and it's a big issue because it's a question of morality. It's a question of rights. It's a question of dignity. It's a question of God. It's a question of Bible. It's a question of conservatism versus opening up. In some sense, listen, me too. I am also I'm a liberal person.
Me too is very important what you just said because.
Because there's a struggle
with
these things.
Those struggles, again, I don't believe in reinventing the wheel. You and I, we face those struggles as Jews and as Jews who believe that halacha is important and meaningful every day, and especially the Torah, for example, right? We struggle, all of Orthodoxy really struggles with this idea that a man can divorce a woman and a woman cannot divorce a man. We have, look, the whole aguna problem and hundreds if not thousands of women are stuck because of this law. Now, we have a lot of compassion for agunas. And we understand that agunas, years ago, 100, 30, 40 years ago, there was no even talk about agunas. But now, there's a sense of talking about agunas. The point is that morally speaing, right, your sense of morals tells you that a man should be able to divorce a woman and a woman should be able to divorce a man. But you also believe that the Torah does not agree. So you, Yishai, have a conflict between your own morality and what it says in the Torah. And you struggle with that. Yisrael. That's what it means. You struggle with it.
You are not in the overt Orthodox fold any longer. You're culturally...
That's what you mean.
I'm phrasing it more as a question, really. I'm not trying to be declarative. I'm asking.
All right.
But outwardly speaking, you're not sporting the look of... You're not wearing a kippah at this time.
Right.
I don't know. I'm not going to ask you if you're wearing tzitzit or whatever it is. I'm not going to get into your tzitzit. I'm not going to ask you if you put on tefillin this morning. Right. I don't know if you keep the Sabbath.
Now you're getting too personal. Yeah.
Yeah. I just don't know. But was orthodoxy too choking?
For me personally. Well, for me personally, I think everybody...
Because, you know, we're in New York, and we could talk a lot about, like, kosher kind of style. Like, you have a lot of Jewishness, a lot of knowledge about halakha, but you yourself are not there in the same place.
For me, it really has less to do with necessarily my LGBT identity, and more to do with, unfortunately, this divisiveness, this focus on the outside. There are things about Orthodox, the people who are not left, the people who are left out of the focus on money. There are things within the Orthodox community that, unfortunately, to me, made it very hard for me to be so excited about identifying with the people that I think have so much value and bring so much purpose to this world. But unfortunately, external things seep into the Frum community and distract it from really the light within, which I do believe so much. So ultimately, identity very, very often has to do with where do you associate yourself communally and politically, denominationally, and it's hard. It's very hard for me to do that when I see women not being treated well, when I see the poor not being treated the same as the not poor, when I see the divisions over Israel, I see the divisiveness that has come to define the Orthodoxy instead of a wholesome of love that I... And that's my issue.
What about God? What about G-D?
What about that? I think my relationship with Hashem is a cultivated, interesting, and it's obviously a personal relationship. Ben Adam Lamakom, and I can't say that it's like an old married couple, right? We absolutely love each other, but we want to kill each other. The difference is, it's much easier for him to kill me. All right.
Mordechai Levavitz, with that, we have to finish our interview. We're sitting somewhere underneath Penn Station in some coffee shop. Very New York discussion also,
Before you end, I just want to say one thing.
Go ahead.
I really do. I think it's important.
Go ahead. This is
All of the ideological discussions that we're having is fascinating and should be had. But before anything, we need to know that today, we talked about Mei Sha'arim, today there are hundreds, if not thousands, of gay and lesbian and trans kids in Mei Sha'arim. They're suicidal. Right? That are being kicked out of their homes, that don't know where to do. So regardless of what and how, we can argue on the tactic, right? We can argue on what to do about it, how to do, but let's come together and maybe have different tactics, right? Let's care about the Jews in our community that need us. We are healthy and we have the means and we have the power. Let's focus and help these kids and hopefully make it so that in the next generation, we don't have to worry about taking care of them because they won't be in that position already. Let's both and all of your listeners at least agree on that. If we can, the rest is details.
I certainly agree with you that there's a human face, and I've always approached this issue, which I have my opinions, and I'm passionate about discussing them whenever it opens up. That first and foremost, there's the other person there, and he's a real person. He or she's a real person, or they has become the thing. By the way, I take issue with that. I don't think that you could, even though you might have some kind of a sexual confusion, whatever it is, queerness, whatever it is, I still don't think you can change from a singular to a plural.
Many people in the LGBT community feel the same way as you. Yeah. I mean, those are debates and that we will continue to have, and that's life. We argue about things.
Mordechai Levavitz.
I love it. But we love each other more in the argument, right? The Gemara, that's how we create Ahavas Yisrael, through the debate.
No doubt about it. It's a very human discussion. Part of me also thinks it's a very New York discussion, all this. There's something about the plurality of New York. And I have to tell you, I just flew in from Los Angeles, and I took a breath of relief when the plane landed in New York. There's just something so incredibly... I don't like these silly words like tolerant or multicultural, but there's just a sigh of relief.
There's something very Jewish about New York.
There's something very Jewish,
very Jewish
and very global, and this discussion is where things like this
can
happen.
Let's go to the parade. We're late.
That's right. All right. Mordechai Levavitz, Jewish queer youth. You are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Mordechai Levavitz. Not an easy topic for sure. I want to hear your feedback and thoughts. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. And right now in beautiful Hebron, check out our website, hebron.com. Connect to the story of the fathers and mothers who are buried here. Be in touch anyway. Be part of the story. Next, Rabbi Jesse Horn is a rabbi who I know from Yeshiva Kotel, and I bumped into him on the 747-400 LA, flying home to the land of Israel. Got a chance to talk to him about his views, why he was in America, and the upcoming holiday of Shavuot. So happy Chag HaShavuot. Here's Rabbi Jesse Horn.
Rabbi Isaac Nissenbaum, one of the founders of the religious Zionist Mizrahi movement, wrote, "The objective of Mizrahi is the total revival of our nation in all its aspects, to revive Judaism in our hearts and to revive our hearts for Judaism. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement."
Have you ever planted a grapevine? What if the grapevine happened to be in the Land of Israel? Not only that, but if you were a Christian planting this grapevine in the mountains of Israel, you would be fulfilling prophecy that Isaiah and Jeremiah foretold more than 3,000 years ago. I'm Joshua Waller with Hayuvel, and I invite you to fulfill prophecy on the mountains of Israel by joining us this harvest. Go to Hayuvel.com, that's Hayuvel.com for more information.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to the Land of Israel Network, thelandofisrael.com. And we are usually broadcasting from Jerusalem, but you know that I have this tendency to be on the road, and in this case, part of my trains, planes, and automobiles style, we are once again in the airplane, so we're on air right now, in the air, over some European places with some little lights below. And it's nighttime right now, somewhere over Europe, and we are heading into the Land of Israel, coming back after a long trip, a 9-day trip that led me to beautiful places like Phoenix, Arizona, Los Angeles, Camarillo, just joking, Camarillo, California, and of course, the great New York City. So that's all been great, and then the whole time been counting the Omer. That's the 49-day count from the second day of Passover until Shavuot, Pentecost, count 50. It's been also a great adventure to be able to see so many great people, like my good buddy Andy Wells from Connecticut and New York, who was so great to see him, a listener to the show. It was so awesome, and many other listeners to the show. Pinchas Farber and his awesome wife, my good friend Mordechai Fishman. Just in general, got a chance to see fantastic people throughout the United States, lovers of Israel, supporters of the cause. And the whole time been counting. Oh, I got to Pico Robertson. Wow, that was awesome. Pico, I ate the kosher food of Pico. I went to Mexikosher. Finally ate some of that famous Mexican food of Los Angeles. And in general, connected with a lot of good people and a lot of good energy. And at this time, and all this time, I've been counting the Omer. And that Omer count, that 49-day count, until Shavuot, my personal favorite holiday. And during Shavuot, I try to spend my time in my favorite yeshiva, I'm not going to lie, which is Yeshivat HaKotel, the Kotel HaKotel Yeshiva, overlooking the Temple Mount, the Western Wall from its Beit Midrash. I've been to many Batei Midrash, I've been to many Torah study halls, but for some reason, and I don't know why, really, I have no real explanation, that's the one for me. I just feel good there. And one of the outstanding characters at Yeshivat HaKotel and the Beit Midrash there is also one of the taller ones, and his name is Rabbi Jesse Horn, or Rav Jesse, and he is a senior educator at Yeshivat HaKotel, coming back right now from a wedding that he officiated in the United States. One of the beautiful things that I guess he gets to do is to connect with his students that he taught and changed their lives over the years, and then they need him. They call him into America to help officiate the wedding. Rabbi Jesse, we're getting ready for Shavuot. Thanks so much for being with me here on the 747-400 and the good folks at LA.
Pleasure. Good to be here. Nice to see you.
So, Rabbi Jesse, tell me about the wedding. Tell me why you went out to the United States. You went for a real short little like Torah strike. You like had a little jet strike over there.
Yeah, it was quick in and out. A day and a half I was there. One of my close students, a close Talmud, a close student. His name is Tzvi Goldstein. Got married, and we developed a relationship about 5 years ago as one of my closest students. We kept in touch, and he was kind enough to fly me out to officiate the wedding. It was particularly special, not just to spend time with him and the other students, but he actually finished at the wedding all the Gemaras that exist, which is called the Siyum HaShas, a tremendous accomplishment to finish all the Gemaras that exist, thousands and thousands of pages, each one with tremendous depth, and it was just a fantastic experience to combine the two. On the one hand, his wedding and moving forward into this career with such a wonderful accomplishment.
So he finished studying all of Shas, all of the Talmud, at his wedding. That is pretty cool. That is pretty cool. Where was the wedding?
Brooklyn, New York. He actually married a Sephardi girl. It was a fantastic chuppah. You really felt a tremendous flavor of different Jews. There were Sephardim there, there were Ashkenazim there, there were people a little bit more to the right, a little more to the left. One of the rabbis actually who was under the chuppah with me from Chicago, Rabbi Zev Cohen, walked over and said, it's a real achdus of Klal Yisrael, Jews coming together from all different dimensions. It was just very, it was great to see the different styles and customs kind of pulling together and making a wonderful, wonderful chuppah as it was.
Now, one of the places in this world, I didn't get out to this on this trip actually, but one of the places, interestingly enough, my mother, who, God bless her, still living in New York but making Aliyah this summer, asked me to bring my daughter with me. She's on this flight on the way back home as well. And one of the things that we did was we actually took a subway to Brooklyn and walked across the Brooklyn Bridge. How many people do you think were there? Thousands. Thousands were crossing the Brooklyn Bridge. I couldn't believe it. What a mass of people. Any case, very beautiful views, of course. One of the things about Brooklyn is that it really does unite, but by itself, that borough and together with Queens really does unite tremendous amount of different kinds of Jews, Russian Jews, Hasidic Jews, Sephardi Jews, all kinds of Jews. And when you're there, there's, for me at least, just like in general in New York, some kind of tension or frustration or challenge in that, for my estimation, it's like the other Israel. There's like a million Jews there almost, 800,000 Jews, nobody really knows the real number. All the different stripes, and a lot of Judaism. Don't say that it's just some kind of big pool of assimilation. Not at all. It's quite Jewish, and the flavor is very Jewish. And for us, people who can be broadly identified as Zionists, people who are yearning for the land of Israel and the great return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, there's a tension, there's a pain. You're at one of the premier Zionist yeshivot, famous for helping people get into the atmosphere and the mood of joining the army and making Aliyah. What's it like for you to go to a wedding that's, on the one hand, bringing together all these various types of Jews, as you said, Achdus, which is unity, and finishing the Shas, which is the value of Torah, and yet it's all happening in Brooklyn. Is there a tension there?
I'm not sure there's a tension. There certainly are different values that exist in the world. On the one hand, one of the values is Zionism and building the country and people moving there, especially those who could. That's a fantastic thing. And on the one hand, it's certainly always nicer when wonderful occurrences happen to take place in Israel. Simultaneously, I think one has to understand that right now where we are as a nation, the whole world's not ready to move to Israel tomorrow. And therefore, to continue religious success and growth there is fantastic. There is a certain sense of tension. On the one hand, every time I go back to America, I feel a certain sense at home and a certain sense away from home at the same time. I grew up in New Jersey, and I know the streets, and know the neighborhoods, and as I crossed the bridges, I remember back to childhood, crossing these bridges with my parents in the car and whatnot. Simultaneously, it's a tremendous privilege for me to raise my children in the land of our forefathers and, raise my children whether overlooking the Har HaBayis when they come to Yeshiva for Shabbos, or whether it's just living in Neve Daniel where we live and walking on what they call the Derech Avot, the path of our fathers, which is, according to many archaeologists and academics, the path that Avram Yitzhak took when they went to the sacrifice, when Avram went to sacrifice his son at the story of the Akedah. So on the one hand, you have a lot of Judaism in Brooklyn and other areas in New York, and for that matter, the world. And it's a fantastic thing to connect to those areas of Judaism. It's also nice to connect to those areas of Judaism in the Jewish home, and I guess that's even nicer. So there's a lot of what I like there, and I guess even more what I like in Israel.
Yeah, I just want to clarify, it's because of the liking that there's a tension. It's not because, you go to some places, and I've been to some Jewish communities where you're like, okay, this thing is on its way out, and I don't know why you guys are here. And there's been articles written like that. I remember that Carolyn Glick once got in trouble after she wrote a pretty scathing article about South African Jewry. I would never talk in the way she spoke, but there was a, you know, but in New York and America, it's the opposite. There's a success and an attraction there. And that's why I think America is most like Babylon, Babel, in terms of Jewish historical experience, where the Jews really never got kicked out of Babylon. It never ended up in some kind of horrible thing until very, very late. Basically, some people say, my mom told me that it was Saddam Hussein who closed some of the yeshivot of Sura and Pupandita at the end of the day. The bottom line is that that's where the tension exists. So, Rabbi Jesse, do you have anything to add about the... This phenomenal election season, it is very unusual, isn't it? There's some really unusual characters there.
Well, for starters, I would make two quick, I guess, precursory statements. Number one is I'm not 100% sure I agree with your total assessment of the characters, but we'll leave that aside for right now. Secondary, as a rabbi, I try my best to avoid the discussion of politics, especially American politics, because I feel that my primary job is to help people grow spiritually and religiously, and I find myself often distancing myself from people who I disagree with politically, and I try my best to clarify this, what I think the Torah values are, especially in America, and you should use those values to figure out how you should feel and how to vote on the issues, and for me to, so to speak, spell that out, I think I end up causing more damage than than good. It's very unusual. You know, a lot of what interests me is that on the one hand, I feel that there's this incredible forward movement, a progressive world moving towards a more liberal world, and it's speeding up incredibly quickly. And I think people are pushing it forwards more and more and more, and those are a lot often the Bernie Sanders supporters. I think they're looking just to push the envelope as far as they can, and I think there's almost a backlash. And I think that's what really the Donald Trump supporters, many of them, capture. Let's slow down. Let's not just take this as crazy as possible. Let's slow down on immigration. It's not, you know, let's not take Western culture to the point where perhaps it undermines itself and destroys itself. The truth is that Trump supporters, I think, fall under two categories. On the one hand, there's the more, I guess, pegged group, you know, that people talk about, the uneducated, you know, that type of crowd. But there's a lot of sophisticated, well-educated Ivy League Trump supporters who I've come in contact with in my life. Many of them feel, even that Trump may even be a buffoon, they just feel like he's putting his fingers on all the right issues. And even if he has an incoherent plan as to how to implement it, they genuinely are frustrated with the almost carelessness and dangerous speed that the world is moving in without any sense of checks and balances. And, you know, they feel like Trump's going to kind of slow that down. And even if he's a little bit racist or politically incorrect, or he says things that really are hurtful and offensive, their response is like, enough with the world tiptoeing around getting offended. Let's just call it how it is. And I feel that's a lot of the tension going on in America, for that matter, the world, in the Orthodox world, in the Jewish world. I feel like a lot of the tension going on in the world today is, on the one hand, Western values take us to an extreme conclusion, and if we value them and nothing else, we should be moving with it. And many people out there say, slow down. Like, the ramifications of taking Western values to their extreme is just dangerous, and it may even undermine the culture and fabric of society that we have today.
It certainly undermines identity, I think. If a, you know, white and Christian country kind of forgets that, or in our case, let's say a Jewish country for Jewish ethnicity with Jewish values incorporates liberal values, ultra-liberal values, to the extent that it forgets its own identity and its own foundational identity, it certainly is dangerous. Liberal values are good, but when they start to kind of like put yourself in a situation where you have forgotten your own clear identity and what it's all about, not in a xenophobic and racist manner, but in a certainly grounded, that you know what your house is, and that you know that you're the owner of the house, and you know that who's supposed to be living in that house and how they're supposed to behave, that's certainly the case. You think that Israeli Americans, meaning to say people with American citizenship living in Israel, should vote in the American election?
I think as American citizens, we have certainly a right to vote. I pay taxes as an American, and I feel an obligation to the best American citizens I can. Obviously, I feel an equal, if not greater, responsibility to Israel. I think that's where my heart is first and foremost, both as a Jew and as an Israeli. That having been said, sure, I try my best to be a wonderful American citizen. I pay taxes, and I vote. I think not just I have a right to, but a responsibility to, and I think... You know, I mean, perhaps even as a religious responsibility, one should help navigate and guide the world in the best possible direction they think that it can go in. And if voting in an American election will help bring the world to a better place, or I imagine certainly the America has the power to do that, you know, so I think one should use the values that they've cultivated through Torah, wherever they come from, and make the best possible decision they can.
That's an interesting point. I think I appreciate that point. And I'm going to have to reassess a little bit my own personal take on this, because for a long time I thought to myself, I'm not going to be voting. I haven't voted. And the reason is because I thought to myself, I don't want to be kind of dishonest. I'm not really a resident of the United States. I'm not as concerned. I'm concerned with my issues, which are Israel issues. So why should I vote in a foreign sovereign in a foreign country when it's really not nogeh? It doesn't touch me so much. On the other hand, yes, as a Jew, I should be concerned with navigating, helping navigate the world. And I am a citizen of that country, and I do respect it, and I do pay taxes there. So I have that right, and I should exercise it. It's an interesting tension. It's an interesting... I always think it's like an ethical tension. Yeah, what would you want to say?
No, I would just add that, you know, if you're nervous that you may have an Israeli agenda over an American agenda, I think having to be an Israeli agenda is a legitimate agenda. It's for the best of the world. And there's all sorts of American citizens voting with significantly less noble agendas than what's best for Israel, one of our wonderful allies. And I think that you should not feel dishonest taking into account, you know, what your values are. One of the great things about the American country is that they allow you to have your values and respect your values and encourage your input and vote based upon those values.
Interesting. So if anything, I think that's something valuable that has come out. We're speaking with Rabbi Jesse Horn. He's a senior educator at Yeshivat HaKotel. We're at the middle, in the galley of the 747-400 El Al. So speaking of Torah, you keep on going back to this word Torah. Another way of talking about Torah is the word Sinai, the Sinaitic experience, receiving the Torah at Sinai. And we're about to enter into a holiday that in some ways is the least identified in the Bible. It's a huge holiday. It's one of the three festival holidays. And yet, what its rationale is hidden. And we know through the Torah that is passed down through the oral tradition that this holiday is about the receiving of the Torah. And basically, 49 days on the 50th day after the Exodus from Egypt, we receive the Torah at Sinai. And so, too, we go through this purification process of these 50 days. I also have tears in my eyes a little bit about the question of whether I have been able to completely prepare myself in the way I would have liked to prepare myself in these days. And I know the answer is no, and I have a few more days to just really push it hard to get there. Shavuot happens to be my favorite holiday. It's my number one holiday. I don't know really why, but I know I feel it. And it's also tied into the Baal Shem Tov. It's tied into David HaMelech, King David. They have their yahrzeits on these days, their passing days. We read the Book of Ruth, one of the great biblical narratives. Shavuot is a time of great drama, when the mountain, the Sinai desert mountain, turned green, where the ram's horn was heard, where the commandments were kind of heard simultaneously, different parts of the commandments, where the Jewish people actually died when they received the first two commandments in a massive nuclear explosion of God's revelation, and God gave them their souls back. There's something about this holiday which like blows you away if you can feel it, and certainly most felt on and below Mount Moriah, which is the Mount Sinai, kind of the Sinaitic experience, happens every year. The revelation happens every year. And you get to be part of that throughout the year in preparation for this experience, because you're really teaching and bringing people the Sinaitic experience, really from Mount Moriah right across from it. That's a pretty big privilege, Rabbi Jesse. Tell me a little bit about that and a little bit about Shavuot. How do you, we're flying to the land of Israel in this darkness right now, and we're about to just enter the maelstrom of Shavuot.
I always say there's two things in the world that people want. One thing is happiness, and the other thing is happiness, pleasure, and enjoyment, and the other thing is truth. And the only way, truth and purpose and a sense of mission, the only way you can synthesize the two is with religion. And I think our message should be to the world exactly that. If you want to live an enjoyable, pleasuresome life, I think the Torah clearly is looking to help facilitate, while simultaneously a life of meaning and truth and purpose, where you can look into the mirror and say, I'm doing with not just what I want, what I believe is objectively correct, what I believe God wants. If you can synthesize those two together, if you can integrate those values of truth on the one hand and happiness on the other, I think that's a fantastic thing. And perhaps even the pasuk, the verse, Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, to serve Hashem with happiness. It's not just serve Hashem. but do it in a sense of happiness. Synthesize those two. Love, you know, the decisions we make are based upon living lives that are enjoyable and happy. On the other hand, doing what we think is right. And perhaps there's no greater way of accomplishing that than the Torah. And I think if we can show that to the world, that the values of the Torah are on the one hand true and on the other hand, you know, enhance one's enjoyment. I was talking to a different person on the flight in, and she was telling me she grew up with a Jewish mother and a Catholic father, and Catholicism was all about, you know, all about what you can't do and what you shouldn't do. Judaism is all about questions. She said the reason why she chose Judaism is because she felt it spoke to her more. And I told her, listen, on the one hand, I hear that. On the other hand, like, there's a certain sense of your decision, and I'm glad you chose Judaism, but, like, it should be based upon what's true and not just what feels right to you. And I think that synthesis of doing what we know is true and know is the word of Hashem and Dvar Hashem and combining that with an enjoyment of it, I think that's ultimately the formula which can take us to that level, take it to the next step.
Rabbi Jesse Horn, thank you so much. Happy Shavuot to you. Thank you so much. You just flew into the United States to officiate at a wedding. Now we're flying back home. It's nighttime over Europe here on the El Al airplane. Somehow we're standing here somewhere between heaven and earth. And that's exactly where we're going to be when we receive the Torah on Shavuos night in the old city of Jerusalem. All right, folks, that's the end of the show. It's so great to be with you here. I've been with you on the planes, trains, and automobiles, and, of course, the offices of the Jewish community of Hebron and my beautiful studios also on the Mount of Olives overlooking the Temple Mount. So you are plugged into the story of Israel when you're plugged into the show and to our network, which is thelandofisrael.com. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. You can connect to me on Facebook, on Twitter, and on LinkedIn, and on YouTube. Everything is at Yishai Fleischer. Most important is that you connect the story of the God of Israel, which is at the Torah, at Jerusalem, at Hebron, and at the Land of Israel. I hope you are part of it. I know you are part of it. So keep strong, keep broadcasting, and stay tuned. More great stuff is on the way. Chag Sameach and Shalom.